Please feel free to have a seat. If you are a kindergartner through fifth grader at this time, we would invite you to head to Harbor Kids for the morning. We're excited for programming this morning and to spend time together. For the rest of you, good morning. This is a day to celebrate as we can consider this 10-year milestone of Jamestown Harbor Church. I think it is fitting that we just sang this song about blessing the Lord and praising His name, because ultimately He is worthy of all of our praise and He is so faithful. As we gather and worship this morning, I wonder a question. Have you ever found yourself saving one of your child's or grandchild's drawings, one that maybe they even scribbled years ago? You tuck it in a drawer, or you put it on the fridge, or you put it in this memory box. You tuck it away for later. I know that I've done this as a mom many a time over the years. Why do we do that? Art therapists say that children's artwork is more than just these cute and colorful drawings, that it's the snapshot of a moment in time in a child's life. Jashley Boatwright, she's a board-certified art therapist. She describes the meaning of kids' artwork, and here's what she has to say. Art, and for young children in particular, drawing, is how they make sense of the world around them. It offers them these insights into their world, into their thought processes, and into their feelings. Boatwright reviewed this artwork of a preschooler named Max at the beginning and end of the school year, and she noted these subtle changes that happen already taking place during his year of preschool. We see two drawings, right? The one on the left is the one from the start of the year, and it's a self-portrait of Max, and you'll notice that he doesn't have any arms. So here's what Boatwright notices about that. She said, you know, it could be that he's just hurried or distracted. He forgot that detail. Or maybe it's actually a subtle indicator that he feels this lack of choice or this helplessness. Because see, you see on the other picture at the end of the year, he does have arms. So there is this sense of improvement or empowerment that he felt along the way. And then Boatwright also went on to comment about how much more detailed the second picture was. That you can see how the noses have changed. There are ears on the picture. And you can also notice that Max is identifying with someone in the picture. We think it's probably his dad. And here's what we notice about that. They both have these mismatched eyes and feet. All of this to say, from that picture that Max put together, that you can see these little signs that he's saying, I'm like you, Dad. I am one of you. We hold on to these crayon scribbles or these watercolor smudges because on some deep level, we know that there is something real, something honest that they reveal about the child in that moment. That their identity, even if they don't know it yet, is starting to take shape. And the truth is, we're not all that different, are we? We may not use crayons or construction paper, but we are constantly creating our own ways of expressing who we are, searching for meaning, for connection, for belonging. Sometimes we're just trying to figure out how to make sense of the world. And if we're honest, sometimes we're left asking this question, who am I really? We live in this culture where people are valued simply because of their appearance. We live in a culture where a person's worth is often measured by how many likes a photo gets on social media. We live in a culture where growing older can sometimes feel like becoming invisible. We live in a culture where people feel pressure to add a filter to their picture before they're going to share it with friends or post it. We live in a culture where kids may worry about their appearance before they learn how deeply they are loved. We were created in the image of a holy and loving God, formed in the image of God, not for display, but for relationship, for purpose, for belonging. And yet in our world, that image is so often distorted by voices that tell us that our value lies in how we appear, not to whom we belong. This may feel like a straightforward question, but what do you see when you look at yourself? Beneath the surface, beyond the mirror, what do you see when you look at yourself? Do you see what God sees, or only what the world has taught you to notice? Am I letting the world tell me who I am? Too often, we allow our culture to shape our identity or other people's voices to shape the view of ourselves. Last week, we kicked off this new series from the Old Testament book of the Song of Songs. The Song of Songs is a poem that is written from the perspective of an older couple who's looking back on their relationship. And the poem looks at these early days of attraction and all of those insecurities that are on display when we first meet someone that we're attracted to. And then the poem continues on through the couple's wedding and then into their marriage. And like all marriages, there are these moments of great joy, and there are also the moments of disconnection and arguments, hard moments. This poem has all of that within it. And so with that being said, we're going to dive back into the poem today. And as we explore Song of Songs together, let's keep in mind this straightforward but foundational question together. What do you see when you look at yourself? And we're going to consider how we may discover more information, more thoughts on this question, on identity, through an ancient poem in Scripture. Because last week we really were starting by setting up the whole series, we're going to begin in the first chapter of Song of Songs with verses 1 through 4. But before we start reading the scripture together, I think it's important to note again that Song of Songs is a dialogue, that we are going to hear from the woman, from the man, and from friends. And the woman begins by speaking, so her words introduce this basic theme of the book of Song of Songs. So with that, let's dive into the scriptures together. Solomon's Song of Songs. This is the words of the woman. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. And then the friends respond, we rejoice and delight in you. We will praise your love more than wine. We hear this voice of the young woman who delights in this man. Who is this man that she is speaking of? She calls him the king. She's not yet married to him, but it becomes clear that they're engaged and that they can't wait to be together. His love is described as better than wine, and his character is described as perfume poured out. Last week, Pastor Jeremy described the significance of this statement. Who he is, his character, is out there for everyone to see and notice. His character is constant, it's consistent, and everyone sees it. And her friends agree, the woman is not alone in this assessment of the man's reputation and his character. And the introduction begins with this announcement of approval. Her friends approve of him. And then the woman turns and she shares a word about herself. Let's continue in Song of Songs 1. How right they are to adore you. Dark am I, yet lovely. Daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I am darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I had to neglect. Tell me, you whom I love, where you graze your flock and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? Okay, let's take the meaning of this, of the woman's words, verse by verse. So we're going to start in verse 5. The woman expresses the self-awareness of her appearance. Here's what she declares. Dark am I, yet lovely. And when she says this, she's acknowledging her suntanned skin, a result of tending to the family's vineyards. Every culture has a standard of beauty, and often those standards are set by the wealthy. In our day, tan skin is something that is considered attractive, right? Tan skin shows that you have free time to go to the pool or to head to the beach. It shows that you have enough money to actually be outside. We comment on this when someone comes back from vacation and says, nice tan, right? But in Solomon's day, the opposite was true. dark skin meant that you didn't have any money, that you had to work outside. And we learn that she has to work in the vineyards. Probably she is aware that other people don't respect her, and perhaps she's even worried or afraid that the man may consider her unattractive. In verse 6, we read that the woman is working with her brothers who deal with her cruelly. They have power over her life, and they use that power for their own advantage. She implies this sacrifice of her personal care because she's doing the dutiful work of the family. And then in verse 7, the woman directly addresses this absence of the man whose love is more precious to her than anything. One of the basic themes that we're going to see throughout this poem is this intense desire that this couple has for one another. And it's expressed through this constant seeking and finding. What is the woman seeking? She's seeking her man, right? And what does the woman see when she sees herself? Here's what she says. She says, "Dark am I, yet lovely." She also says, "I had to neglect my vineyard," her body. "Do not stare at me because I am dark." In other words, she has these insecurities. There are these things that she loves about herself. She says, "I'm lovely," but there are also these things that she doesn't. She's aware that there's this cultural standard of beauty and that she doesn't meet it. And so she says at the end, "Don't look at me." The woman in Song of Songs reveals something that many of us wrestle with, this feeling of not being enough in the eyes of others, that we may not fully believe that we are loved and lovely. She says, "Dark am I, yet lovely," holding both her insecurity and her worth in the same breath. She knows she is beautiful, but she also fears how she's perceived, shaped by this culture that tells her otherwise. This tension is alive and well today, isn't it? We're told by the world that our value comes from how we look, what we own, or how others see us. In his book, Life of the Beloved, writer and theologian Henry Nouwen speaks directly to this tension. Here's what he writes. "Every time you feel hurt, offended, or rejected, you have to dare to say to yourself, these feelings, strong as they may be, are not telling me the truth about myself. The truth, even though I cannot feel it right now, is that I am the chosen child of God, precious in his eyes, called the beloved from all eternity, and held safe in everlasting belief." Nouwen's insights remind us that if we accept these cultural definitions of worth, when we find our identity in how others perceive us, there's a risk. We risk losing touch with the truth of who we are before God. Our identity is rooted in something deeper, but we often question it based on shallow expectations. The woman's words here remind us of this deep and ongoing human struggle, this tension between how we are seen by the world and who we truly are. Her words, "Dark am I, yet lovely," reveal both this vulnerability and also this quiet strength as she holds insecurity in one hand and recognition of her worth in another. The same tension plays out over every season of life as we're shaped and sometimes distorted by the cultural expectations that often define our worth in shallow ways. As a child, when we identify and are defined by how we perform in school, in sports, in activities, we can start to feel that our worth depends on achievement rather than being loved for who we are. As a teen, when our identity is defined by appearance, popularity, or social media likes, we can feel pressured to conform to unrealistic standards of expectation and acceptance. As young adults, when our identity is defined by a picture of success, of career, relationship status, and financial independence, we may feel like failures if our path does not match a timeline that is set by others. As an adult, when our identity is defined by the image that we project, whether it be as a parent, as a partner, or as a professional, we can lose ourselves in our roles rather than rest in who we are. As an older adult, when our identity is defined by productivity or relevance, we may struggle to feel valuable in a culture that idolizes youth and overlooks wisdom. You see, in each stage, there are these pressures of how we are seen at the surface. And there is a real sickness and sadness that permeates the soul of our culture right now. How do we reject these shallow definitions? And instead, how do we reclaim the deeper truth that we are already seen, known, and loved by God? The woman says, "Dark am I, yet lovely." She understands how the world may not see her as lovely. And yet she also sees something beautiful about herself. She recognizes that her identity is rooted in something deeper. And that's the question for us, isn't it? How do we get there? To place that we can recognize cultural standards that we know that we may never match up to, and yet still find ourselves seeing ourselves as worthy and beautiful. To get to that, I think it's important for us to take a few minutes on theology from the beginning, from the book of Genesis. We find in Genesis that God is taking disorder and darkness and chaos, and instead he is creating order and beauty and goodness. He creates this world where life can flourish. There's this repeated pattern that we see in the book of Genesis, in Genesis 1, where we read, "And God said, and it was good. And God said, and it was good. And God said, and it was good." There is this repeated pattern. It becomes this rhythm within creation. And then there's a change. Instead of, "And God said, and it was good," it's, "And God said, and it was good." Very good. What happens in that moment? He creates you and me. He creates humanity and he calls us very good. When God creates humanity, the rhythm changes. No longer is it just good, it's very good. And it's not just poetic, it's intentional. God sees the inherent worth and value before we've done anything to earn it. Let me say that again. God sees inherent worth in us before we've done anything to earn it. Our value isn't tied to appearance, productivity, or the cultural standards that we find ourselves in. We are simply good because we are his. Here's what we read in Genesis 1, verse 27. "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." We are made in the image of God, male and female, reflecting his likeness. And to be made in God's image is to be inherently worthy, set apart not by what we do, but by who we belong to. And in a world that tries to define our worth by how we look or how we compare, Genesis 1 reminds us that our identity is rooted in being made by God and called very good by him. Where this becomes difficult is in Genesis 3, where sin enters the story and it fractures this original sense of identity and worth. Because in Genesis 3, that is where we start to see that moment of shame entering in. The serpent deceives Eve, questioning God's command, and she and Adam eat the forbidden fruit, and immediately their eyes are opened and they realize they are naked and they feel shame. In Genesis 3, verse 7, after eating from the tree, we read, "Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked, so they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves." Where there was once unashamed vulnerability, there's this hiding and fear. And in verse 10, here's what Adam says to God, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." This is the moment when many of us can experience this same dynamic, this place of shame, of being afraid of hiding, of covering up what God had called very good. Sin distorts our understanding of ourselves and of each other, and it makes it harder for us to believe in this inherent beauty and worth that we find within ourselves. In Genesis 3, this first sign of sin is shame, where Adam and Eve realize that they are naked and they feel this need to cover themselves. And that same impulse to hide, we may experience today, especially in how we view our bodies. The struggle is particularly pronounced in young people who are bombarded with these distorted images of worth and identity and beauty from a very early age. According to the National Eating Disorders Association, by the age of 17, 80% of teenage girls reported being dissatisfied with their bodies to some extent, internalizing this lie that our value is measured by appearance. And it's not just girls. The Journal of the American Medical Association reports that 1 in 3 teenage boys use unhealthy methods like excessive exercise or supplements in an attempt to fix their bodies. For many young people, their bodies become something that they're managing or manipulating or hiding. And the pain begins at a very early age. A report by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says that 53%, over half, of 13-year-old girls are already unhappy with their body image. These statistics reveal more than this normal experience of teenage self-consciousness and more of a cultural divide that creates a spiritual wound. An identity crisis that's rooted in comparison, distortion, and cultural pressure. There is a multi-billion dollar marketing machine that is trying to convince us what it looks like to be beautiful, and it is hitting young people harder than any of us. This conversation about identity, parents and grandparents, is deeply important as we raise our kids. Our love, our words, our recognition, and our support shape them profoundly, and the church has to name it. Our world needs the church on the front lines because we cannot keep going like this. I was struck by this conversation that happened at our youth group last week. We had almost 50 middle and high school students that came together with their leaders this past Sunday. And here's what they talked about: finding their worth in God and not in what the world tells them. Being rooted and remembering that they are fearfully and wonderfully made. These are the words that the church needs to speak over our youth and really over all of us, right? Our identity is rooted in something deeper than what we see in the mirror by being created in the image of God and called very good. And yet in Genesis 3, we see how sin introduces shame, distorting this truth and making us forget who we really are. Where in your life are you tempted to hide or cover up what God has called good? As the story continues in Genesis, we see that shame isn't the only result of sin. There are also real consequences that impact every area of our life. When Adam and Eve disobeyed God, something became broken, not just in their relationship between God and Adam and Eve, but within themselves, in their relationship with one another, and in creation. In Genesis 3, verses 14 through 19, God speaks to the serpent, to the woman, and to the man. To the serpent, he says that there will be this ongoing conflict, and one day the woman's offspring will crush his head. To the woman, he speaks of pain in childbirth and a complicated desire for her husband who will rule over her. And to the man, he says that the ground is cursed, work will become toil, and that life will end with death by saying, "From dust you are, and to dust you will return." These are not arbitrary punishments. They reveal how sin fractured the beauty and order of creation, introducing pain into relationship, identity, work, and even the ground itself. To the man, God says, "You will look for your worth in your work." And to the woman, he says, "Your desire, your worth, you're going to look for it in him." This still happens today. Friends, work can affirm you, but it cannot define you. God gave man a purpose in work, but not an identity in it. We often try to prove our worth through success, achievement, and performance, but it can never satisfy this deeper need that we have for connection. From the beginning, God said that it was not good for man to be alone. We are made not just to produce, we are made to be known and loved. And friends, another person's love can fulfill you, but it cannot complete you. God tells the woman of her longing for her husband that this reflects this desire not just for connection, but to be seen and chosen and valued. That desire points to something that's beautiful, right? But it's also delicate. Because if we are trying to find our identity solely in another person, we are going to be left disappointed or unseen. These words that God speaks to Adam and Eve, they actually draw them closer to him. And these words, they draw us closer to God to help us to see that our needs are never going to be met in another relationship or in our work. It is ultimately and only God who can meet our deepest needs. Our identity is rooted in something deeper that comes from being made in God's image, but often we seek our value in work, relationships, or the approval of others rather than in how God made us. Who are you? Who are you really? What do you see when you look at yourself? If you were to ask the people who know you best these same questions, how would they answer? Would they say the same things that you think of yourself, or would they say something else? These questions bring us back to Song of Songs. For the man in the song, he's consistent. He is who he is, and who he is like perfume poured out, according to the woman. He's not just good to her, he's good for her. Let's take a look at this exchange in the first few verses of chapter 2 of Song of Songs. Listen to what the man and the woman say to each other. Let's start by listening to what she says to him. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. And then he responds, like a lily among thorns is my darling among the young women. He takes what she says about herself and he adds to it. You're not just a flower. You are a flower among thorns. There is no one like you. And then here's how she responds. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my beloved among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. Let me lead him to the banquet hall, and let his banner over me be love. The woman says, I delight to sit in his shade. She could still be making reference to the apple tree, but I think we could miss something important that she's saying. Remember, she says, dark am I yet lovely, holding both her insecurity and her worth in the same breath. There are her insecurities, the things that she wishes she could change. And then what does she say about the man? I delight to sit in his shade. The very thing that causes her the greatest insecurities, he covers it. He protects her from it. Not only does he bring out the best in her, but he also protects her and shields her in the face of her greatest insecurities. If you're here today and you're in a relationship, if you're in a marriage, are you providing shade for your spouse? Are you a safe place where your partner can open up and be vulnerable and know that they will always be loved? With those who are closest to you, with your family, with your friends, are you offering shade or are you adding insecurities through your words and actions? We started today with this question, what do you see when you look at yourself? It's a deeply personal question. And for many of us, if we're honest, it's a complicated answer, isn't it? Too often we see ourselves the way that our culture shapes us. A culture that says that we're not enough unless we look, act, or achieve a certain way. Words from others who have wounded us and have left a mark. Or our own inner critic that never seems to quiet down. But the truth is, our identity should only and ever be shaped by God. In Song of Songs, we see this glimpse of what God's love looks like. We see someone speak not just to insecurities, but into them calling out beauty and worth and belonging. We see that love doesn't expose weaknesses, but instead it covers it. It protects it. It becomes shade. This is the kind of love that we are meant to reflect in our marriages, in our families, and in our friendships. This is also the kind of love that we receive from God. So as we go into our week, here are a few questions that I would invite us to all reflect on as we think about how we engage in relationships with one another and how we see ourselves. Here's the first question. What voice is shaping my identity right now? Is it the voice of our culture, shame, comparison? Or is it the voice of God, our Creator, who calls you very good? How can I offer shade to someone else? Who needs to have a person of peace? Someone who's offering protection and affirmation right now. How could you be that person to someone else? And here's the third question. Am I reflecting God's love in a way that helps others to see their true identity? Do your words build up others, especially when they're feeling most exposed? As you sit with these questions this week, remember this: the one who knows you fully also loves you completely. In Christ, our worth isn't found in what others say about us, but in what He has done for us. Now let's go back to this memory box that holds these drawings of our children and our grandchildren. On Facebook Marketplace, if we're going to put them out there, they're probably not worth a whole lot, right? But to you, they're priceless. Why is that? Because they belong to the people that you love the most. That's how God sees you. Your worth has nothing to do with what you've done or what you've left undone. God loves you simply because you are His. He doesn't toss your picture aside. He treasures it. He treasures you. So may we choose to see ourselves the way that God, since page one of our Bible, says that He sees us. This morning, we have the opportunity to again participate in communion with one another and to receive the grace that reminds us that of who we truly are in Him. This time, I would invite Pastor Ben to come up as we share in communion together. Friends, in Christ, our worth isn't found in what we have done or what others have said about us, but instead, we are reminded that we are truly loved because of what God has done for us. He has silenced every false voice, and He has instead spoken a better word, a word of love, a word of worth, and a word of identity. And we can rest in that identity of being beloved, chosen, forgiven, and redeemed. We're invited to come to this table where Christ affirms who we are in Him.